understanding at a deep, intuitive level. The transformative power of a cessation event depends on how unified the mind was. Unification determines the overall size of the audience of sub-minds receptive to events in consciousness. Only the parts of the mind system that were tuned in during the cessation are affected. If the mind were completely unified, then every sub-mind within the mind system would be affected simultaneously, and there would be a complete awakening of the entire mind system. However, if the mind system was only partially unified, there are two possibilities: no transformation or incomplete transformation. This is because a certain degree of unification is needed during the event to reach enough sub-minds to make any tangible, lasting difference to the whole mind system. With too little unification, a person may have a very memorable peak experience, but with little or no lasting effect. However, if the critical threshold is reached, the second possibility is an incomplete transformation of the mind system, limited to those sub-minds that happened to be tuned in at the time. Complete transformation must await subsequent cessations or other insight experiences that have a similar impact on the remaining parts of the mind system. This incremental process of transformation explains why awakening is traditionally described as occurring in a series of stages. Extending the mind system model. The mind system model has great explanatory power. Yes, it's a simplification of a complex reality, but that's why it's so useful. We have pictured the mind system as consisting of the conscious mind surrounded by and connected to the unconscious, sensory, discriminating, and narrating minds. The conscious mind is a locus where information exchange takes place, and consciousness refers specifically to the actual process of information exchange. Who is conscious is the collective of unconscious minds that exchange information in this way. But by revising the model just a little, we'll have an even better one that answers a number of questions the basic model can't easily explain. It will also help explain the subtleties of mind revealed in meditation and provide a useful framework for interpreting the practice instructions in the next stages. The revision is simple, but the implications are profound. The same basic structure of the mind system is repeated at many different levels. This means that each unconscious mind, communicating via the conscious mind, also consists of a collection of its own sub-minds. For instance, the auditory mind that sends information into consciousness also has a collection of connected sub-minds. These are responsible for a variety of processes such as pitch, intensity, duration, and so forth. Each of these sub-minds is in turn a collection of sub-sub-minds, and this structure keeps repeating itself down to the very simplest of mental processes. This also means there are multiple conscious mind-like loci, where consciousness-like processes of information exchange occur at every level in the hierarchy. This repeated organizational structure, in which the exact same processes that produce consciousness happen at deeper and deeper levels, shows the fractal nature of the mind system. The only reason the particular information exchange process we call consciousness is special is because we experience it subjectively, and that subjective experience seems to be limited just to information exchange occurring at the highest level in the mind system. Likewise, there are narrating mind-like processes responsible for combining, organizing, and summarizing the information that appears. Some part of the information in each exchange locus gets projected to the next, higher exchange locus, just as some of the contents of consciousness get projected into the world as speech or action. Sometimes the information is in its original form when it moves up to the next level. Often, though, it has been modified by condensing and combining it with other information. Therefore, what appears in consciousness as the content of a discrete moment of consciousness is really the output from many different unconscious sub-minds and sub-sub-minds, meaning it has already been extensively compiled and sorted. This revised model also gives us a better picture of how intention works. According to the mind-system model, all intentions are generated in the unconscious mind. The role of consciousness is to allow, suppress, or modify these intentions before they produce an action. However, if the unconscious intentions rising into consciousness were always simple, conditioned reactions, similar situations would always generate the same intentions. But this isn't what happens. Also, new intentions arising into consciousness are often already quite complex. That's because much of the evaluation, modification, and vetting of competing intentions has already occurred at an unconscious level. Finally, extending the mind-system model gives us a new perspective into the nature of all conscious experience. The content of consciousness is actually the output from many different sub-minds and sub-sub-minds. It consists largely of binding moments. All the individual bits of sensory information have already been extensively combined, analyzed, and interpreted before we ever become conscious of them. This means that our conscious experience of ourselves and the people, things, and events we know as reality is made up entirely of highly processed mental constructs. Information processing in the sensory mind. To gain a more complete picture of this upgraded mind-system model, let's look at the kind of information exchange that happens within the sensory mind as a whole. Information from all the different senses gets exchanged via a conscious mind-like, but still unconscious, information exchange locus. For example, auditory information can contribute to the processing of visual information, and vice versa, such as when its auditory mind can't recognize a sound, and the eyes search for its source. This also allows information from different senses to be bound together. Knowing which person is saying the words you hear is an example of this type of pre-conscious binding. Looking closer at individual sensory minds, each one is actually made up of a number of sub-minds. The visual mind, for example, is comprised of many different visual sub-minds, each processing different kinds of information coming from the eyes: color, brightness, contrast, lines, shape, motion, etc. These visual sub-minds communicate with each other by projecting information into a conscious mind-like location. Then all the other visual sub-minds have access to the information and can incorporate it into their own processing activities. This process of information exchange within sub-minds is exactly like what we call consciousness at the highest level of the mind system. But because it happens at a deeper level, it can never be part of our conscious experience. If we could somehow look inside the sub-minds of one of these sensory minds, say the visual mind, we would find that it doesn't process visual information as images, or even as sense percepts like contrast, color, and shape. It only converts that information into sense percepts or images at the highest level, before exchanging it with other parts of the mind system. As an analogy, consider computers. Images serve no purpose within computers. Rather, all input must first be converted into ones and zeros before the computer can use it. Then your computer converts the results of its processing activities from ones and zeros into an image on your monitor so it's meaningful to you. Otherwise, the information within a particular sensory mind appears as something just as unintelligible as ones and zeros. But between sensory minds, information is communicated in the form of sense percepts like color, warmth, and sounds that are meaningful to the entire mind system. Sense percepts are the lingua franca of the mind system. Inside every sensory mind, there is also a submind that binds sense percepts together. In the visual mind, information from many different visual sub-minds is integrated into a recognizable image. These highly composite images are what ordinarily get projected into consciousness. In other words, what we become conscious of are mostly binding moments of consciousness, each containing a filtered, pre-sorted, and pre-assembled synopsis of the vast amount of information continuously flowing into the brain from the eyes. The cost associated with all this integration is a huge loss of information at every level of binding, which reaches colossal proportions by the time it reaches consciousness. However, a certain amount of detail is restored to perceptual experience because some simple, unbound sense percepts, like color and contrast, get projected directly into consciousness, interspersed among the binding moments. This is precisely what gives normal visual experience its richness and texture. Normal sensory perception consists of a mix of discrete moments of consciousness, reflecting many different levels of information processing in the sensory mind. There are the simple, unbounded sense percepts, like color, temperature, pressure, and pitch. Then there are the binding moments that combine sensory percepts. Contrast, brightness, color, and shape are combined to create an image. Pitch, loudness, timbre, and sustain are united to make a musical phrase. The normal tactile experience of the breath is another example, consisting of a multi-level integration of touch, pressure, movement, temperature, and so on. Finally, there is the higher-level unconscious binding activity that combines information from the different senses. Drugs and certain kinds of brain injuries produce bizarre sensory effects by altering the mix of bound and unbound sensory information reaching consciousness. Something similar also happens when we see or hear something we can't recognize because the sensory mind can't make sense of the information it receives. We can feel our whole mind struggling to make something meaningful from them as different components of sensation appear in consciousness. Information processing in the discriminating mind. The conscious mind is where the sensory, thinking, emotional, and narrating minds exchange information. When projected into consciousness, the content of all the various sensory mind moments becomes available to the discriminating mind. The thinking, emotional mind then conceptually identifies and evaluates that information before adding it back into the stream of conscious moments. The conceptual and emotional output of the thinking, emotional mind then becomes available to the sensory and narrating minds. The narrating mind performs the highest level of information binding within the mind system as a whole. Attention and awareness each have their role in this information processing. Attention extracts specific parts from the vast amount of information contained in these moments of consciousness for more processing. Most of the time, attention selects, processes, and reprojects complex, high-level binding moments. These are the high-level moments that get bound together by the narrating mind. The function of awareness, on the other hand, is to selectively deliver to consciousness whatever attention requests for analysis. Although conscious experience is dominated by perceptions derived from high-level binding moments and narrative moments of consciousness, its richness comes from individual sense percepts and lower-level binding moments. This richness increases proportionately when the content of consciousness shifts toward more low-level information processing and away from complex binding, abstract thinking, and storytelling. The increased richness and detail that comes with being more fully present is an example of such a shift. Applying the revised model to meditation experiences. With stable attention and powerful mindfulness, we can witness events in the mind system that simply aren't accessible to the untrained mind. This is because intentionally directed and effortlessly sustained attention has a powerful effect on what appears in peripheral awareness. When we choose to attend to certain kinds of mind moments and ignore others, those moments become much more apparent because they increase in frequency, while the others decrease. In particular, when we preferentially attend to lower-level binding moments and basic sense percepts, it narrows the overall range of mind moments, making these stand out much more prominently. Thus, sustained selective attention can give us access to the many different levels at which raw sensory data gets converted into our familiar conscious experience. The exceptional power of awareness and attention then allows us to observe these different levels of information processing with great clarity. Take the example of the acquired appearance of the meditation object at stage 6, when conceptual interpretations of the breath fell away. This was the first time you became so fully and continuously conscious of individual sense percepts. Prior to this stage, they were fewer and scattered among a large number of more complex binding moments, such as those producing recognizable experiences, such as in-breath. But as attention focused more on the sensations of the breath, the mind system responded by providing more mind moments involving simple sense percepts. At the same time, conceptual and other more complex binding moments arising in awareness were consistently ignored, so higher-level binding moments decreased. As the proportion of simple sense percepts increased in both attention and peripheral awareness, perception shifted to become more direct and less conceptual, and you experienced individual sense percepts directly. The well-trained mind of an adept can witness processes and events at an even more subtle level. If you did the practice of close following described in Stage 7, you may have experienced sensory information before it was converted into a sense percept. This type of close, fine-grained observation is not available to ordinary consciousness. That kind of raw, unprocessed sensory data appeared as a vibratory flux, empty of meaning. Not only is information in that form unrecognizable, but the mind system as a whole tends to recoil from the experience in great discomfort. This practice pushes the tactile, sensory mind to project information into consciousness in a form usually exchanged only between tactile sub-minds. Like the ones and zeros of a computer, this information is meaningless outside of that particular sensory mind. This type of information never becomes conscious except as part of rare drug experiences, or brain injury, or in meditation. As you move into Stage 8 and beyond, you will engage in practices that allow you to further examine other subtle mental processes. For instance, in the meditation on dependent arising in Stage 8, you will investigate fleeting thoughts and sensations. You will realize these are binding moments of consciousness, and the aim of the practice is to unbind them, so to speak. You will deconstruct these sensations and thoughts to become aware of the feelings, cravings, and intentions that were bound together with the thought or sensation in the unconscious. In later stages, you will also start to realize how our sense of time and space are the result of unconscious binding activities. Consider time. Our ordinary sense of events happening in time appears immediate. We watch as events unfold. But think about all the different sensory subminds at work that have to organize, store, and integrate this information before it becomes conscious. Each sense percept that appears in an unconscious information exchange locus quickly passes away to be replaced by another. To become meaningful, a series of individual sense percepts must be stored, and when enough have accumulated for a pattern to emerge, they are bound together in a way that reflects their relationship over time. This temporal binding is a fundamental kind of binding that necessarily precedes most other kinds. What we actually experience in consciousness, therefore, are binding moments with the sense of time already embedded in each moment. In more everyday terms, what we experience as real time is actually after the fact. Time is, in a sense, packaged into mind moments by the unconscious sub-minds to be unpacked later in consciousness. Temporal binding moments are always being projected into consciousness, but can only be clearly discerned once most other binding moments have been excluded. For example, during the early part of close following meditation in Stage 7, you experienced the breath as jerky pulses of sensations. Those pulses are instances of what temporal binding moments look like in relative isolation. The idea of your experience of time as a mental construct may initially seem foreign, but you will gain first-hand experience as you progress further. By the time you reach Stage 10, you may be able to experience temporally extended events as a whole, without the time element being fully unpacked. This preconceptual, temporally bound sensory information can also be used as a meditation object to enter very deep jhanas. Spatial binding is another fundamental form of information binding. Visual percepts and sounds, for example, are located on an internal mental map of surrounding space with our body in the center. In the same way, tactile percepts are associated with specific locations on an internal map of the body. Spatial binding is so ubiquitous that we usually become aware of it only by its absence. You may have already experienced one example of this in stage 6, when the breath seemed to appear disconnected from the nose. This dislocation happens when breath sense percepts become divorced from our internal map of the body. All such meditation experiences clearly demonstrate that our sense of space results from unconscious sub-minds organizing, integrating, and projecting binding moments into consciousness. These are just a few examples of the different unconscious processes contributing to conscious experience that can be revealed through meditation. As you proceed, you may also experience how temporally and spatially bound sense percepts from different senses get combined together in the unconscious. Another possibility is seeing how bound collections of sense percepts arrive in consciousness already recognized and labeled. These are further integrated with other stored concepts, allowing their potential significance to be evaluated. Then, still more conceptual binding gives rise to desire, aversion, loving-kindness, compassion, and other forms of intention. From these, in turn, flow the even more complex conceptual formations that produce actions and reactions. Any or all of these phenomena, and a variety of others not mentioned here, may be revealed in meditation. The nature of consciousness. To make the mind-system model even more accurate, we need to make one last change. The particular information exchange locus we have been calling the conscious mind is not a place or a locus after all. The information exchange process we call consciousness doesn't actually happen in a particular part of the brain, nor is it even a specific function of the brain. That was just a convenient way for us to talk about it. Consciousness is simply the fact of information exchange, and refers specifically to information exchange occurring at the highest levels in the mind system. But information exchange happens at every other level in the mind system, too. Information exchange anywhere, in any form, is the result of shared receptivity, and shared receptivity is an expression of interconnectedness. Put another way, consciousness is simply the inevitable result of the interconnectedness of different parts of the brain and of the shared receptivity that results in information exchange between them. The radical interconnectedness of the brain is what makes it so unique and powerful. It has been estimated that there are more possible connections in a single human brain than there are particles of matter in the entire universe. This means that vast amounts of information exchange are occurring at absolutely every level within the brain and nervous system, in every moment. Each and every neural circuit in the brain, even if it is the simplest of reflexes consisting of only two linked neurons, has the property of shared receptivity. The output of one neuron becomes input for all of the other neurons in the circuit. Individual neural circuits are linked together in the brain to produce more complex circuits. More complex circuits are linked together to form functional systems within the brain, and these systems are likewise linked into larger systems. The highest level information exchange process, the one that we experience subjectively and call consciousness, is no different from what is happening at every other level in the brain-mind system. But we are not simply reducing the mind to the brain, nor consciousness to something the brain does. If we think about the implications of consciousness being the result of shared receptivity and information exchange, it takes us in a completely different direction than reductionism. Consider the fact that shared receptivity and information exchange doesn't stop at the level of neurons in the brain. A single neuron is a system of interacting organelles, the specialized structures that make up a cell. Organelles are systems formed by interacting molecules, which are themselves composed of interacting atoms. Atoms are systems formed by the interactions of even subtler forms of matter and energy. Each of these structures, person, brain systems and circuits, cells, molecules, atoms, and so forth, is a natural individual. A natural individual is an entity defined by the shared receptivity and consequent exchange of information between its component parts. This means that every molecule and every person is a kind of unique individual, but it's our interconnectedness rather than an external boundary that gives us our individuality. This also implies that the process of information exchange called consciousness at the level of a person is no different from what is happening at all these other levels as well. Shared receptivity and information exchange doesn't stop at the level of individual human consciousness either. People are interconnected in the form of many different kinds of social units, from couples and families to nations and humankind as a whole. We view these organizations of people as distinct entities and often speak of them as having a kind of group consciousness. Even the United States Supreme Court has intuited a sort of personhood in corporations. It is, of course, a politically and legally problematic comparison, simply because corporations have so much more power than an individual person. Nevertheless, corporations, churches, and political parties all take part in information exchange and thus have a type of consciousness one step above that of individual persons. Pursuing this idea even further, multiple species are interconnected to form ecosystems. Ecosystems are interconnected to form biomes, and the biosphere is formed of interconnected biomes. Both the living and non-living parts of planet Earth interact, changing each other to form a single, complex, interdependent system. Planets and stars form galactic and supragalactic systems. It's not unreasonable to view the entire universe as one single, massively interconnected and interdependent system. Indeed, every structure we have identified, from atoms to persons to the universe as a whole, constitutes a natural individual by virtue of shared receptivity and information exchange. From this perspective, what we call consciousness is just a single, limited example of something that pervades the entire universe at every level. Stage 8. Mental pliancy and pacifying the senses. 8. The goal of Stage 8 is simple pacification of the senses and the full arising of meditative joy. Simply continue to practice, using skills that are now completely effortless. Effortlessly sustained exclusive attention will produce mental and physical pliancy, pleasure, and joy. Practice goals for Stage 8. You begin Stage 8 as an adept practitioner. You can consistently pacify the discriminating mind and enter a state of mental pliancy. In other words, you have effortlessly stable attention and powerful mindfulness. Each sit, it can take a while to reach effortlessness, and sometimes you'll stay at stage 6 or 7 the whole time. But you should be able to reach mental pliancy fairly regularly and remain there for the rest of the sit. Much of the practice at this stage simply involves exercising your newly compliant mind's abilities to explore. You have two goals for this stage. As an adept meditator, with a highly compliant mind due to a complete pacification in stage 7, your first goal is to exercise this mind, explore its nature, and discover and develop its inherent abilities. Think of your mind as an unknown territory where no one else has been and no one but you can go. A spiritual teacher can point you in certain directions, make suggestions based on his or her own experience, and offer valuable methods developed by other meditators in the past. After all, one human mind isn't so different from another, but it's your own needs and interests that will determine how you actually proceed. Follow wherever they take you. I promise you will go places and do things with your mind that are pointless to describe or discuss with anyone who hasn't made this journey on his or her own. The second major goal is complete pacification of the senses, which produces physical pliancy and fully developed meditative joy. Since both pacification of the senses and meditative joy result from the same unification process, we treat them as two parts of a single goal. To pacify the senses, you will exclude all sense objects from attention while sustaining metacognitive awareness. To cultivate meditative joy, you don't need to do anything different or special. Just keep practicing. It will arise naturally once the sensory minds grow quiet and the mind as a whole becomes sufficiently unified. You've mastered stage 8, when your eyes perceive only an inner light, your ears perceive only an inner sound, your body is suffused with pleasure and comfort, and your mental state is one of intense joy. Exercising the newly compliant mind. Your first goal is to exercise the skills you've already mastered in order to explore the nature of the mind and fully develop its inherent abilities. Mental pliancy gives you effortlessly stable attention and sustained, powerful mindfulness, particularly in the form of metacognitive introspective awareness. The practices in the next section will help you experiment with attention. Those in the following section will enhance your metacognitive awareness. When to do which practices? You've probably already experienced some unusual sensory events, bodily movements, energy currents, or even joy corresponding to the various grades of PT. Expect these to intensify through stage 8 until you achieve pacification of the senses and meditative joy. During the first part of this stage, when you're experiencing grades 1 through 3 PT, do the practices described in this section, exercising the newly compliant mind. Toward the end of stage 8, when grade 4 PT starts to dominate, switch to the practices in the section Pacification of the Senses and Meditative Joy. Practices for experimenting with attention. The effortlessness of mental pliancy comes with a distinct feeling of power and control over the mind. The power and control are real, even if the sense of a self who's in control is only an illusion. You may not yet realize the full extent of your abilities. You can focus your attention wherever you want, with whatever size scope you want, and for as long or as briefly as you choose. While sustained exclusive attention played a crucial role in developing your concentration and will continue to be useful to you as an adept, it's no longer a requirement. You can now freely shift your focus of attention from one mental or sensory object to another, as quickly or slowly as you like, and as often as you like, without losing stability. You'll soon discover you no longer need a specific focus of attention at all. Attention can rest in a state of openness, as you simply allow objects to arise and pass away without being captured by any of them. Here are two structured practices for you to try. These are particularly useful for the early part of stage 8, where you're exploring and developing the capabilities of your mind. However, they'll remain useful long after you've moved beyond this stage. Momentary concentration. This practice involves momentarily shifting your focus of attention to various objects in peripheral awareness. Even though awareness is relatively free of mental objects like thoughts and images, sensations are still prominent. These include both ordinary and mind-generated sensations, energy movements, and actual bodily movements. You're also introspectively aware of feelings of pleasure or displeasure, desire or aversion, patience or impatience, curiosity, and so forth. Any of these can become a momentary object of concentration. Your attention is now so stable you can quickly and easily shift your focus from one object to another, maintaining exclusive focus with each. Start by choosing a sensation in peripheral awareness. Any distinct sensation will do. Shift your attention to it, making it the exclusive focus of attention for a moment. Let the breath sensation slip into peripheral awareness or disappear entirely. When the sensory object passes away, attention will automatically return to the breath. Then select another sensation for momentary attention. At first, only practice momentary attention with physical sensations or the mind-generated sensations that arise due to pacification. Once you're confident you can do this without losing exclusive attention or metacognitive awareness, try switching to mental objects like affective reactions and emotions, such as pleasure from hearing birds outside the window or annoyance at an itch. You can even allow individual thoughts or memories to arise, holding them briefly as your object of attention while introspectively observing the mind's reactions to them. Another way to practice momentary concentration is by exploring objects using alternating attention while keeping your primary focus on the breath. Of course, alternating attention is also a form of momentary attention, one where the movements of attention are very fast. It's always been functionally important for the untrained mind in everyday experience. Now, with mental pliancy, alternating attention also becomes a useful tool in meditation. Start by forming the intention for attention to include something you've selected from peripheral awareness. You'll immediately have the familiar experience of attention alternating between the breath and the other object you've chosen. Let your attention keep alternating between the breath and various objects appearing in peripheral awareness, but make sure the primary object is always the breath. Earlier, we would have called these objects subtle distractions because your attention alternated to them spontaneously. Now, however, these movements of attention are fully intentional and effortlessly controlled. Next, experiment with redistributing your alternating attention, increasing the ratio between moments of attention to the other object and to the breath. In other words, the breath will shift from being the primary object, moving into the background, while the chosen object comes to occupy the main focus of attention. This is exactly the same experience we called gross distraction when it happened involuntarily, but it's now entirely intentional. Explore how attention alternates and the type of information this provides. Then consider ways you can use this to learn more about yourself and how your mind works. Meditating on arising and passing away. In this practice, you closely investigate the arising and passing away of various phenomena with attention. While practicing momentary concentration, you probably already noticed how particular sensations or affective reactions arise, then quickly pass away, often to be immediately replaced by a new but closely related object. For example, if the object is an ongoing sound, you will find it actually consists of a series of separate sounds arising and passing away one after another. If it's a single brief noise, you'll notice that even after the actual sound is stopped, it continues to reverberate in the mind. If it's an emotion or mental state, you'll notice that it's actually made of a series of closely related but different mental states, arising and passing in waves. Other times, the new object will be something quite different, but you'll notice there's a causal relationship between it and the last object to pass away. For example, if someone sneezes, as the sound disappears, it may be immediately followed by an image of a person sneezing. When that image passes, it might be replaced by a thought about catching a cold. You can make any of these objects your focus of attention. Because of mental pliancy, whenever the causal sequence comes to an end, your attention will always return to the breath, instead of being captured by something new. It's as though attention were tied to the breath by an elastic band that always pulls it right back. You may have noticed before how phenomena arise and pass away, but the swiftness of your mind and the clarity of your perception now exceed anything you've experienced before. The power and control you have while doing this are very satisfying and quickly take on the qualities of flow, much like what you experienced with the whole body jhanas in stage 6. Although jhana-like, this flow state is not jhana. The main differences are that you have complete intentional control in every moment, which you don't have in jhana, and the objects of attention are constantly changing. It's not unusual to experience grades 3 and 4 PT while doing this practice. Don't get attached to these experiences. Just keep practicing as before, allowing pacification and joy to develop naturally on their own. Exercising the compliant mind and complete pacification of the senses. When pacifying the senses, you're supposed to ignore sensations vying for attention. However, in the practices for exercising the compliant mind, you often focus attention on both ordinary and mind-generated sensations. So, aren't these two practices working against each other? There really isn't any conflict. Even though you're focusing attention on sense objects that you would otherwise ignore, the nature of the object of attention isn't important. What really matters is that there's a consensus of many sub-minds to attend to that one thing and ignore everything else. The same principle applies to the practices of momentary attention and choiceless attention, where attention is no longer exclusively focused on a single object. Even though attention is moving, the objects of attention are determined by a strong consensus of unified sub-minds to the exclusion of anything else, so the result is effectively the same as exclusive attention. If the consensus is strong enough and involves enough sub-minds to produce the effortlessness of mental pliancy, then unification and pacification will continue. If not, the consensus won't be strong enough to stop attention from moving spontaneously to other sensations, and pacification will stall. Therefore, resist the temptation to engage in these practices before you're ready. Practices to enhance metacognitive awareness. Reflect for a moment on the duality between consciousness and the object of consciousness, between the act of knowing and what's known, between the cognizing and the cognized. Attention emphasizes the latter half of this duality, that is, the object of consciousness. Specifically, attention itself creates this polarization of knower and known, then focuses on the known. In the next practices, the emphasis shifts away from the object toward the act of knowing. This means a shift away from attention toward greater metacognitive awareness. Where this ultimately leads, though not immediately, is to a direct experience of the illuminating function of consciousness, the discerning cognition that gives rise to the experience of a known object. From now on, no matter how you use attention, hold the intention for peripheral awareness to become more and more metacognitive, working toward a complete and continuous observation of the activities and state of the mind itself. You don't exclude extrospective content from peripheral awareness or attention. Rather, to whatever extent extrospective sensations are present, they're experienced as part of the activity occurring in the mind, rather than as objects in and of themselves. For example, in the hearing of a sound, the primary object of your observation isn't the sound that's being heard, but the mental act of hearing. This is also true for mental objects. Remain metacognitively aware of them as content of field of conscious awareness, but with the objects themselves being secondary. It's as much about how you know as it is what you know. The next two practices will help you develop and strengthen metacognitive awareness. They can be used for many other purposes in the future as well. Choiceless attention. Recall that some objects arrive in awareness with the intention that they will also become objects of attention. The practice of choiceless attention involves allowing attention to move freely in pursuit of the objects that arrive, with the strongest intention to become objects of attention. In terms of the mind system model, choiceless attention is not truly choiceless. Rather, a powerful consensus of unified subminds has chosen to allow such objects to become the focus of attention. Monitoring this free movement of attention with metacognitive introspective awareness is an effective exercise for making this awareness more powerful. This practice is similar to momentary concentration, except that now you're allowing objects of attention to self-select. Subjectively, you experience attention freely and spontaneously striking or falling on certain objects, one after the other, as they arrive in the field of conscious awareness. This is just like the spontaneous movements of attention in an untrained mind, except now attention never becomes so engrossed as to be captured. Each brief period of intense focus is followed by attention quickly moving to something else. Furthermore, since the discriminating mind is pacified and there's mental pliancy, mental objects don't predominate as they normally would. Most important, however, is the strong, continuous metacognitive quality of awareness present as the objects of attention constantly change. This makes the whole experience into one of observing the mind itself as an ongoing process, rather than merely experiencing the contents of attention as they arise and pass away. Of course, this exercise relates directly to the practice of mindfulness in daily life, where attention also moves freely. Now it will be easier throughout the day to maintain a mindfulness that takes the form of knowing the bigger picture of what the mind is doing and why. As with the meditation on arising and passing away, you may find yourself entering a flow state, accompanied by grades 3 and 4 PT, consisting of incomplete pacification of the senses. This shows that the mind is continuing to unify as you engage in these practices. Meditation on dependent arising. As metacognitive awareness grows stronger, the causal relationships between various sensory and mental events become clearer. This happens because one of the basic functions of peripheral awareness is to perceive the relationships of objects to each other and to the whole. In this meditation, you follow mental events as they occur in sequence. Specifically, consciousness of a sensation or thought, contact, is followed by an affective response, feeling, leading to desire or aversion, craving, then to the arising of an intention to act, becoming, and finally, to the action itself, birth. This is also called following the links of dependent arising, the causal relationship between mental processes described in traditional Buddhist literature. By intentionally tracking these causal links with attention, meditation on dependent arising makes metacognitive awareness more powerful and provides insight into how mental processes unfold. Let's say your ears are producing a buzzing sound. You can direct your attention toward that auditory sensation and observe the associated feeling of displeasure that arises. Then you notice that a desire for the sound to go away arises in response to the unpleasantness. But because you're sitting in meditation, the only option for escape is to direct attention elsewhere. So you observe that an intention to redirect arises. Regardless of whether you act on that intention or not, a new contact event will follow. If attention doesn't move, this whole sequence will repeat, cycling through contact, feeling, craving, intention, and action as part of the ongoing experience of the sound. This will continue until contact of a different sort spontaneously intervenes or attention finally does move. For a more complex example involving thought, let's say your attention falls on the sensation of an energy movement in the body. It's accompanied by a feeling of unpleasantness, which becomes the next object of attention. This is followed immediately by a sense of aversion toward which attention now turns. Aversion triggers an unconscious thought, produced by one of the discriminating sub-minds, which then appears in peripheral awareness with a strong intention to become an object of attention. Attention notes this intention. The action that ensues is a shift of attention to the thought. Now the cycle repeats, this time with the thought as the initial object of attention. It may be a thought about the inner winds, or prana, and because this is an interesting topic, you observe how the thoughts elicit a positive feeling of pleasure. Following this, you may detect the desire to allow this train of thought to continue. This whole process crystallizes into an intention to continue pursuing the next associated thought, and so on. With practice, you can follow this unfolding elaboration of thought without losing your metacognitive perspective. You can just sit back and allow the next thought to appear, following its own sequence of dependent arising. Whether you're investigating thoughts or sensations, analysis is not the point. The content of the thoughts and sensations is mostly unimportant. You're just aware of how they arise and pass away in dependence on each other, and how they're linked together by feelings, cravings, intentions, and actions. As with choiceless attention, this meditation practice strongly exercises metacognitive awareness. Here, however, there is a more specific goal: to acquire an intuitive understanding of the causal processes that drive our ongoing mental activities and which lead us to act and react as we do. If we bring our understanding of how these chains of association work into daily life, we're less likely to react out of aversion or craving, and more likely to act from a place of wisdom. The meditation on dependent arising can have a powerful transformative effect, especially when combined with the practice of mindful review. Unifying the mind, pacifying the senses, and the arising of meditative joy. The second major goal of this stage is the complete pacification of the senses, accompanied by the full arising of meditative joy. Both pacification and joy are different aspects of the same unification process. Pacification and joy are what we experience subjectively, whereas unification describes what happens at the unconscious level. Unification of mind really refers to unification of unconscious sub-minds, and there are degrees of unification, depending on the extent of their cooperation. The degree of unification determines how much pacification and joy we experience consciously. Because there is very little unification in the ordinary mind, attention shifts and vacillates, divided in its purposes. Exclusive attention requires more unification, but only of the unconscious sub-minds currently interacting via consciousness, typically just a very small part of the unconscious mind. Pacification of the discriminating mind develops as more and more sub-minds of the discriminating mind grow unified around the intention to maintain exclusive attention. When there was enough unification, you experienced the effortlessly stable attention of mental pliancy. Complete pacification of the senses happens the same way. When unconscious sensory sub-minds become unified around the conscious intention to attend exclusively to the chosen object, they refrain from doing anything that disrupts exclusive attention. With enough unification of the sensory sub-minds, normal sensory information is no longer projected into consciousness. And when there's enough unification for complete sensory pacification, the mental state of meditative joy begins to arise as well. As discussed in the sixth interlude, you'll encounter various unusual sensations as part of pacification of the senses before achieving physical pliancy. You will also experience energy currents, involuntary movements, and other unusual autonomic effects before the full development of meditative joy. All these sensory events and movements happen at the same time and intermingle. For sake of clarity, however, we first describe what accompanies pacifying the senses, and then we discuss what accompanies meditative joy. Pacifying the senses. Complete pacification of the senses means normal sensory information no longer gets projected into consciousness because the sensory sub-minds have grown temporarily quiescent. Just as complete pacification of the discriminating mind results in mental pliancy, full pacification of the senses results in physical pliancy. With physical pliancy, you can sit comfortably for long periods without discomfort or any sensory distractions. Physical pliancy is accompanied by the bliss of physical pliancy, a wonderfully pleasant sensation pervading the entire body. Even with pacification, the sense organs keep functioning normally. The ear still registers sounds, for example. That sound is also processed by the auditory sub-mind, but it's not projected into consciousness. Any sensation that the unconscious sub-minds identify as unimportant, such as another meditator coughing, a door closing, or a dog barking, doesn't enter consciousness. The same is true for all the other senses. Sensory information still registers in the respective sensory sub-minds, but it's processed only to the point of simple recognition. All this sensory information is still available if and when we want it, but it doesn't appear in consciousness until we intentionally call it up. Although ordinary sensations disappear from awareness, some purely mind-generated sensations persist, including an inner illumination, unusual bodily perceptions, and internal sounds. However, exceptionally strong, unusual, or especially significant sensory inputs are still projected into consciousness. Yet with pacification, they enter consciousness in a way that doesn't disturb our meditation, unless their presence elicits a conscious, intentional response. For example, the ringing of a telephone may enter consciousness, but the mind system as a whole can choose to respond or not. If a fly lands on your face, you can know it's there without any annoyance or concern. And when you recognize the sound of the bell signaling the end of your meditation, the focus on the meditation object dissolves because of a pre-existing intention to respond this way. Sensory pacification happens for two reasons. First, when you exercise exclusive attention, you completely ignore sensations that arise in peripheral awareness. This deprives them of the attentional energy needed to sustain them, so they fade away. Second, when you cultivate metacognitive introspective awareness, you do so at the expense of ordinary extrospective awareness. That is, by turning awareness inward, you deny awareness to normal external sensory input. The combination of these two activities eventually causes the sensory minds to stop projecting ordinary sensations into peripheral awareness altogether. Therefore, all you have to do is keep exercising exclusive attention and cultivating metacognitive awareness, using the practices for exercising the newly compliant mind until the senses are fully pacified. There is only one major obstacle that you must first overcome: unusual mind-generated sensations. Unusual sensations. Before they're unified enough, the sensory minds react strongly to being ignored. They start projecting lights, sounds, and all sorts of strange and sometimes unpleasant bodily sensations into consciousness that have nothing to do with anything happening externally. These mind-generated sensory phenomena tend to dominate this stage. They can be quite disturbing, as well as distracting, since they're so unusual. It's almost as if the sensory minds resist being ignored like stubborn children. Their whole purpose seems to be to capture your attention and arouse your interest. Interestingly, though, the more they do this, the less they project immediate, real-time sensory information into peripheral awareness. This shows that the process of pacification is actually underway. When these phenomena consistently take the form of grade 3 PT, it means you've reached the final phase of pacifying the senses, and the time has come to ignore them completely. The early part of Stage 8 provided plenty of opportunity to explore these phenomena and observe your mind's reaction to them using the practices described in the previous section. This didn't interfere with the ongoing pacification process and hopefully satisfied your curiosity, making it easier to ignore them now and achieve complete pacification. Once pacification is complete, you'll experience Grade 4 PT. Mind-generated sound and light may continue, but ordinary sensations completely disappear, and the chills, hot flashes, pressure, itching, pinpricks, tingling, and so forth are replaced by the bliss of physical pliancy. Meditative joy. As your practice progresses and the mind keeps unifying, meditative joy will naturally arise. This type of joy is a unique mental state that only arises in meditation. To understand it better, let's briefly look at how it compares to joy in general. Although we tend to think of joy as a simple emotional experience, it's actually a comprehensive mental state. This is true of emotions in general. They are functional states of mind. This means they cause the mind to behave or function in very specific ways. They influence what we attend to, how we perceive what we attend to, and the feelings generated in response to what we perceive, all of which exerts a powerful influence over our thoughts, speech, and actions. Joy is also a functioning state that evokes a specific pattern of mental behavior affecting attention, perception, and feelings. First, it predisposes us to notice and preferentially attend to what is beautiful, wholesome, pleasant, and satisfying. At the same time, things that are ugly, unwholesome, or unpleasant tend not to draw or hold attention. Second, the perceptions arising in a joyful mind, no matter what we happen to attend to, always emphasize the positive aspects. The glass will be perceived as half full rather than as half empty, and neither full nor empty. Finally, joy causes our feelings about everything to shift toward the positive end of the spectrum. Something ordinarily experienced as mildly pleasant becomes extremely pleasant. Something neutral, like the simple act of breathing, arouses feelings of pleasure. What would otherwise be mildly unpleasant is experienced as neutral, and what would ordinarily be quite unpleasant is only mildly so. By skewing conscious experience in this way, joy tends to be a stable, self-sustaining state. Selectively attending to the pleasant and preferentially perceiving the good in every situation helps avoid experiences that perturb the state of joy. In other words, the positive effect produced by joy encourages a favorable reinterpretation of conscious experiences that threaten to undermine joy, further adding to its resilience. As pointed out in the sixth interlude, the mental state of sadness or grief is the exact opposite of joy. Sadness orients attention to what is unwholesome, ugly, and dissatisfying. Our perceptions emphasize the problematic aspects of whatever we attend to, and our affective reactions are skewed toward displeasure. Thoughts tend to be pessimistic and cynical, and simply being alive can seem painful. To really grasp the nature of joy, picture a child who has just been told they're going to get something they've wanted for a long time. On hearing the news, they become joyful, excited, and happy, even though they haven't received it yet. The only change is cognitive, but it has put them in the positive mental state of joy. This state will influence the child's perceptions and reactions to whatever happens for as long as it lasts, perhaps hours. For another example, consider when a young person discovers his or her romantic feelings are reciprocated. They feel joyful, exhilarated, and happy. Life's problems seem to fade, and the world is seen through rose-colored glasses. A lover's mind is oriented toward the positive, preferentially sees beauty and goodness, and ignores or looks right through the negative and unpleasant. As in these examples, joy has an energetic, excited, even agitated quality. It's often accompanied by tingling sensations, flushing skin, bouncy, spontaneous body movements, goosebumps, chills running up and down the spine, and enthusiastic verbal expressions. Whenever there's a state of joy, there's also a feeling of happiness. But the two aren't the same. Happiness is not an emotional state, but a specific feeling, the feeling of mental pleasure. Happiness is a component of any pleasurable emotional state, But you can also have happiness by itself. Note that the mental pleasure produced by joy is independent of physical pleasure. The feeling of happiness that joy brings can coexist with and even allow us to ignore physical pain. Joy causes happiness and increases bodily pleasure. In turn, any pleasant experience, mental or physical, can contribute to the arising of joy. There is a reciprocal causality operating here that, beginning on either side, can create a self-sustaining positive feedback loop. As long as we keep attending to the pleasurable and ignoring the unpleasant, the state of joy will be sustained, at least until something interrupts this feedback cycle. Joy seems to be the default state of a unified mind. With ordinary joy, the immediate trigger is the prospect of fulfilling some worldly desire, and the sub-minds of the mind system unify around that desire. In the previous examples, the child and lover become happy because they are going to get what they want. Happiness brings about a temporary unification of sub-minds, which are all in agreement about the object of desire, and this leads to a joyful state of mind. But meditative joy differs significantly from ordinary joy. Unification in meditation is due to mental training rather than gaining some desired object. It also comes from resolving inner conflicts through purification and mindfulness. As unification proceeds, conflict between sub-minds ends and the usual state of inner struggle ceases. Then, once the mind is sufficiently unified, meditative joy arises spontaneously. As with regular joy, meditative joy generates happiness, referred to as the bliss of mental pliancy. However, we don't have to wait for meditative joy to arise spontaneously via unification. We can actually make it arise earlier. For example, we can use the feelings of satisfaction and happiness that come with your success in meditation to trigger it. This, in turn, can help speed up the unification process, because by intentionally cultivating meditative joy, you invoke a feedback loop. Joy causes happiness and physical pleasure. Happiness and physical pleasure increase unification, and unification causes meditative joy. Once set in motion, the loop ensures that as the mind grows unified, the joy and happiness it produces will induce still greater unification. Meditative absorptions, jhana, are flow states that can also help you take advantage of the positive feedback loop between unification, joy, and happiness.